The story of D-Day has been told many times, but in a new book, the best-selling military historian Anthony Beaver tackles the whole story from the Battle for Normandy up to the liberation of Paris. Unlike previous accounts of this most famous amphibian assault, he includes not only the military side, but the political, human, and diplomatic impacts of the campaign. His book, D-Day, The Battle for Normandy, includes contemporary accounts, overlooked material, and fresh perspectives to tell the story. And I'm very pleased that this book, which is published by Viking, has brought Anthony Beaver to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
You've tackled Stalingrad, Berlin, the downfall, the battle for Spain, and some of your other books. Were you at all dissuaded by the spate of books and documentary films about D-Day that are already available?
Well, no, because the main books on the subject, Carlo d'Este, Max Hastings, John Keegan or whatever, all came out in the 1980s, and there's been a huge amount of new material since then.
And nothing, only one other book since the 1980s?
Well, there have been lots of books about different aspects, but no major general history of the whole lot. And it was Martin Blumenson, the great American official historian of Normandy, who was the one who actually persuaded me to do it, because after Berlin and Stalingrad, he felt it was terribly important to make a comparison between the Eastern Front and the Western Front.
You also say that neo-Nazi websites have been reviving conspiracy theories as to why the Wehrmacht was defeated in Normandy, and you felt you had to counter them.
That's absolutely right. I think that it's rather alarming, but not altogether surprising, that the Nazis and even the neo-Nazis today see Normandy as a form of the stab-in-the-back theory. They felt that Hitler and the Nazis had been betrayed by staff officers and aristocrats. This time...
Well, Rommel was there, and he was an opponent of Hitler, wasn't he?
He was. He wasn't actually part of the July plot, but he was certainly sympathetic and wanted to get rid of Hitler, but he believed in having him on trial rather than assassinating him.
You said that new material has come up. I would have thought by now everything would have been mined. So what are the new things that have turned up, the new sources?
Well, mainly as people die or grow old, many of the diaries and documents and letters are handed over to archives. And particularly in France, the Mémorial de Caen has one of the most astonishing collections from many different countries, Canadian, German, French, British, and American.
And then there's new material from combat historians who interviewed soldiers and officers about their experiences?
Well, that was there in the archives, and interestingly, although Martin Blumenson and others used them as background material, only one or two historians have actually used them properly, I think, in terms of quoting from them, because they give the real feeling of what it was like at the time.
There is a real air of romanticism about the Battle for Normandy. I'd like to play something by a speech by Dwight Eisenhower that he gave to the soldiers before the landing.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
He was promising a lot, and then he said good luck.
Well, luck did play a very large part. I mean, if it hadn't been for the weather, if it hadn't been for that gap, that window in the bad weather, things could have been very nasty.
Is that why this battle has captured the imaginations of so many people? Or is it simply because it was so incredibly bloody?
I think that it was bound to be an iconic moment, the liberation of Western Europe from Nazi oppression. So, I mean, it was a very emotional moment, particularly for the British, who'd been defeated time and again and had to withdraw from the continent. And obviously for American and Canadians, they were there to end the war as rapidly as possible. But it was bound to be a moment on which there was, in a way, almost too much emphasis, because all the focus was on D-Day rather than on the real fighting, which was actually the battle for Normandy afterwards.
What are some of the biggest myths about Normandy that you've encountered?
Well, I think one of the biggest, in a way, was that D-Day was almost decisive in itself. In fact, it was just the start of the true battle. And I think that we've intended to underestimate the savagery of the fighting in Normandy itself.
And nobody ever talks about the civilians. You write, altogether, 19,890 French civilians were killed during the liberation of Normandy, and an even larger number seriously injured. That was on top of the 15,000 French killed and 19,000 injured during the preparatory bombing for the invasion in the first 5 months of 1944. Well, the two questions I would have is, why were so many French civilians, 70,000 in all, killed in this operation? And why have we heard so little about that aspect of this operation?
Well, I'm afraid that on the whole, military history has never tended to look at civilian casualties. And I think it's rather important, particularly in the case of Normandy, because it brings out this terrible paradox that the armies of democracies are liable to rely that much more on high explosive, on bombs and shells, to try to reduce their own casualties because of pressure at home by the press and public opinion. Generals try to reduce those casualties by using that much more explosive.
Well, we come up with these odd names like collateral damage.
Yes.
Although, what did they didn't use that during World War II.
No,
did
I think
they just
that
simply
was a,
say
that
civilian
was a Hague
casualties?
Speak. I think that was a Hague speak or something like that. It was, well, they just talked about sort of civilian casualties. And even before the invasion, Churchill was horrified by the number of French liable to be killed by the preparatory bombing. He wanted it to be limited to 10,000, but in fact it went to 15.
My guest is Anthony Beaver, whose latest book is D-Day, The Battle for Normandy. It is published by Viking. One of the most controversial aspects of your book is that you argue that the British D-Day bombing of the French town of Caen was stupid, counterproductive, and above all, very close to a war crime. Well, why would the British have done that? We've already been through the Dresden bombing.
Sure.
And the arguments for and against. But Caen?
Well, when I made that phrase about, so when I said close to a war crime, that was wrong, because I said that during the course of a very, very long interview, and it was in the heat of the moment, because a war crime would be a deliberate killing of civilians. The trouble was that the Allies thought that by dropping leaflets and putting out radio messages that somehow they'd be able to evacuate civilians from 60,000 population from the city of Caen before they started to bomb it.
And nobody paid any attention? Did people
well,
not
some
evacuate?
People did and some people, but only a few hundreds managed to get out of the city in time. The trouble was they started bombing at midday and they smashed the city. But that was a total blunder from the military point of view, because if you smash a city before you're supposed to capture it, it turns it into the perfect defensive terrain and it prevents your armored vehicles from entering.
Was taking Caen, I have trouble pronouncing that because I know Caen, C-A-N-N-E-S, but C-A-E-N is what we're talking about. Was it critical to the success of the overall mission?
Well, it was vital from the point of view of the British on their flank, because the whole idea was that they could advance far enough forward to start establishing forward airfields and all the rest of it. And that was supposed to be the hinge of the attack. But Montgomery's master plan, as he called it, in fact, came to a halt very, very rapidly. He had failed to foresee that the Germans would send the bulk of their panzer forces against him. And that's why there was so much disagreement and resentment on the behalf of American generals against Montgomery.
I've read any number of histories of World War I in which quite a bit has been written about the suffering of the French people, the Belgian people, but didn't hear much about it until this in World War II, until this history. Why is that? Is it because we've seen this only in terms of the liberation of the French?
I fear that's the case, yes. But I think it's also because military historians in the past have just sort of concentrated purely on the military aspect and have tended to overlook the suffering of the civilians caught up in this sort of terrible fighting.
We've learned in recent years that many French were perfectly happy under this new regime. There was a resistance, but it wasn't as strenuous as French films would suggest. So we're is that what was life like before the invasion? Were people very happy to see these the Allies enter their towns and bomb their areas?
Well, I think they have very mixed reactions. I mean, General Patton made the famous remark when asked about the contribution of the French resistance, saying it was better, more than expected, but less than advertised, which is a very sort of Patton-esque remark. Under the occupation, certainly the Norman farmers didn't do badly. They had sort of law and order, and they were able to sell their products, particularly on the black market, very well.
It was the two of the greatest wine years in Bordeaux history occurred during the occupation.
Well, absolutely right. But there was also one of my favorite stories in a way was of this American tank platoon arrives in a Norman farmyard, and the farmer comes out with Calvados and cider, and all of the American tankers drink Vive la Liberation. And then the farmer turns to the young officer and said, right, that'll be 100 francs. And he said, but what? We just liberated you. And the farmer replies, well, that's no more than we charged the Germans.
Has there been a lot of pent-up resentment of the Americans and British for the Battle of Normandy?
I think that 1944 saw a very difficult period of French-American relations. I mean, the French were very, very thin-skinned after the humiliation of 1940 and the occupation. And, of course, the Americans were a little bit thick-skinned, I think, in underestimating how much French pride had been damaged. And so relations between France and America have actually been deeply affected for many years as a result.
Apart from the bombing of Caen, were there some other aspects of the invasion that resulted in unnecessary deaths, both civilian and military?
Well, I think that basically the strategy was, and particularly of the American army, was to use artillery in massive quantities to reduce their own casualties, and one can understand that. But at the same time, it did obviously put that many more civilians at risk.
What about French military? Were many French soldiers fighting on the German side?
No, there were very few French on the German side.
It was mostly, if they weren't Germans, they were Russians and Poles.
Absolutely. Well, any French fighting on the German side were actually the SS, but they were on the Eastern Front. But the real foreigners, if you like, fighting in Normandy were Russians, former soldiers of the Red Army, who'd been recruited forcibly into the Wehrmacht, and also Poles.
My guest is Anthony Beaver, who is the best-selling author of 5 nonfiction books, including The Battle for Spain, Paris After the Liberation, 1944-1949, Stalingrad, which won the Samuel Johnson Prize, the Wolfson Prize for History, and the Hawthornden Prize for Literature, and The Fall of Berlin, 1945, which received the Longman History Today Trustees Award. His latest is called D-Day, The Battle for Normandy. It is published by Viking in this country, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Anthony Beaver, whose latest book is D-Day, The Battle for Normandy. It's published by Viking in this country. It was first published in Europe just ahead of the 65th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and I'm guessing there were some people who strongly objected to some of your assessments.
I've had one or two former generals saying that I was unfair on Montgomery.
But well, you are really tough on him.
Well, I am, and frankly, I think he deserved it. But anyway, and I'm sure people won't disagree too much with that over here. But I, on the whole, no. I mean, what was encouraging was that the French certainly seemed to approve of the book. One or two people felt that I was too kind on the French resistance, but it's very difficult to assess how effective resistance is.
Did the French appreciate this because they felt that they hadn't been given voice in at least in English language publications?
Yes, and I mean, I think that the lack of attention to the suffering had always sort of riled them a certain amount. But I think also one needs to understand the difficult relationship between Roosevelt and de Gaulle. Roosevelt had been very much prejudiced against him, largely actually by French people living in the States during the war, not just by Admiral Leahy.
You talked about the air aspect of the invasion, and we have a clip of a news report of the first planes at the start of the invasion.
The last aircraft of the first batch taking off to carry British paratroops into the continent of Europe has just left the station. And all around us, for miles and miles, people are going to their beds this night, not knowing that this operation has begun. They will know within 12 hours. Meanwhile, there's only the noise of the departed aircraft to tell us that the attack on Europe has begun.
Do you believe in the end that the invasion as a whole should be called an unqualified success?
It was definitely a success. There's no doubt about that.
That's why I said unqualified. Obviously, it was a success because despite all the carnage, the battle was won by the Allies.
Well, I mean, there are certain qualifications. I mean, it could have been a greater success. I think if Montgomery and Bradley had got their act together at the end and had managed to seal off the German army more effectively. So, I mean, there are always certain elements which you can criticize.
Although it's been claimed that Operation Neptune, the crossing of the Channel, is one of the greatest military planning achievements ever from the invasion itself through the follow-up operations.
Well, it certainly was. The problems actually started because they had not foreseen the difficulties ahead immediately afterwards. But there were also difficulties, whether it was the bombing support on Omaha Beach, which went completely wrong, and a number of other aspects. But the actual naval part was superbly planned.
And Omaha Beach went wrong because it had been planned poorly?
Well, it was partly the aerial bombardment. I mean, they knew that Omaha was going to be tough. Bradley had been warned very clearly, and he knew perfectly well the situation. But when the Air Force insisted on coming in from the sea and not following the coast with the bad visibility, it was almost inevitable that they were going to miss all the targets.
So Bradley and Montgomery are the two who come in for the most criticism by you. Sir Bernard Montgomery is portrayed in your book as having a breathtaking, I'm quoting, a breathtaking conceit, which almost certainly stemmed from some kind of inferiority complex.
Yes, that's certainly true.
Was it really that bad?
Oh, it was. I mean, no, there was something sort of psychologically very strange about the guy. But he was a very good general in some ways, and he was a very good trainer of troops and all the rest of it, and we owe him a lot for what he did in North Africa. But I didn't think that Normandy was necessarily his finest hour.
And Bradley, we've named tanks after the man. He wasn't as good as we Americans tend to think he was?
Well, no, I don't think I'm criticizing Bradley very much here. The only thing I really criticize him for was for lack of communication with Montgomery at the crucial moment towards the climax of the battle.
Could lives have been saved if they had planned better? British lives, especially?
I think that's perhaps true. Where Montgomery completely misunderstood things, even though he'd been warned, was the way that the Germans were bound to concentrate the bulk of their panzer forces against the British and the Canadians rather than against the Americans.
You write that the night before the landings, de Gaulle called Churchill a gangster and Churchill called de Gaulle a traitor.
Yes.
So is that a snapshot of Anglo-French relations in 1944?
I think things were very, very bad indeed. And I'm afraid a lot of it was this tension which really came between from Roosevelt. But it was much more de Gaulle's pride and the exasperation of the Allies.
Well, he was living in exile in England.
Yes.
And did the British expect him to be more grateful?
I think they did. I mean, Churchill afterwards said that of all the crosses he had to bear, without doubt the heaviest was the Cross of Lorraine.
What about General Dwight D. Eisenhower? How effective was his leadership in military planning?
Well, I think that Eisenhower was a brilliant supreme commander. Montgomery was very condescending, trying to say, nice chap, no soldier. But in fact, Eisenhower's decision-making, on the whole, was almost perfect. I mean, you can't really criticize the big decisions he had to make, and they were very big indeed. One could say that he didn't grip Montgomery enough, but I think that was... I think he was trying to sort of allow Montgomery a certain latitude.
I was surprised to learn that he smoked four packs of Camels a day.
Well, I think he was under a lot of pressure, and I don't really blame him for that.
He also seemed to have a bit of a sentimental side. He had tears in his eyes as the 101st Airborne Division took off from Grenham Common.
Well, he wasn't the only one. I mean, that clip you just played of the aircraft taking off, I mean, all over England, where in southern England, when they heard this armada of aircraft taking off, people went out into their gardens, out of their houses, to watch them in the night sky, and then many went back in and prayed by their beds. So Eisenhower wasn't alone, though.
Now, we've been talking about incompetence, or I don't know if incompetence is the right word, but not totally great leadership on the part of the Allies. What about the German opposition? You write, and I'm paraphrasing, that Hitler showed a blind faith in the defensive Atlantic wall that was perplexing in a man who had so ingeniously outmaneuvered the Maginot Line so easily 4 years earlier.
Well, that's absolutely true, but fortunately for us, Hitler was a prisoner of his own propaganda. He literally was sort of self-convincing and would come up with all of this stuff, partly to persuade his own generals that they were going to win, but in fact he was actually lying to himself.
And what about the rest of the German high command?
Well, they, of course, were absolutely stymied by the way that Hitler refused to give up any ground at all. And I think it's very significant that British Special Operations Executive decided to cancel any plans to assassinate Hitler because they realised we did rather better having Hitler in command.
Weren't responsibilities for the German army being shared between Rundstedt and Rommel? And didn't they disagree about how to deal with the invasion?
Yes, there was a very major disagreement over strategy. But once the battle had started, both Rommel and Rundstedt agreed that they had to have flexibility of command, which Hitler was refusing to give them.
What about the quality of the soldiers? We mentioned earlier that by 1944, one-fifth of the Wehrmacht forces in France were made up of Poles and Russians who had changed sides earlier in the war. Were they committed soldiers?
Oh, not at all, and especially not the Poles, who'd been forced into the German army against their will. I mean, whenever there was an opportunity, they'd shoot their own officer or sergeant so as to be able to surrender to the Americans or the British.
A listener asks how accurate you think films like Private Ryan and Band of Brothers portrayed D-Day.
Well, I think Band of Brothers was far superior to Saving Private Ryan. I mean, the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan is very impressive cinematography. But the last part of the film is basically a cliché. I mean, it's a Hollywood cliché, rather like the sort of an upmarket version of The Dirty Dozen.
One aspect of this book is that you talk about the legacy of D-Day. What is the legacy? Did this lead to tension between the various participants in the years that followed?
I think that was bound to be the case. I mean, I don't think any country really loves their liberators. And certainly the French, after the humiliations they'd survived, and also the way that American troops during the winter of 1944 regarded Paris as sort of the place just to let off steam. This didn't actually go down terribly well with the French after the way that they had suffered, I think.
One of the things that I was surprised to learn was that many soldiers in the German army were convinced that New York had been destroyed by German bombers.
Well, this is the extraordinary effect of Goebbels' propaganda. Not all obviously believed it, but a large number, and particularly the more fanatical, certainly the Waffen-SS, they were prepared to almost believe anything because it had become like an addiction of hope.
Was this the first war where we heard about a pinpoint bombing? Because we still hear about this sort of thing, again and again, with more and more sophisticated equipment, we seem to miss targets. What was it like at this point where they just would open the bottom of the plane and a bunch of bombs would drop out? How close did they come to the targets?
Well, I'm afraid that the claims of the U.S. Air Force at the time, saying they could drop bombs in a pickle barrel, were completely misleading. And this is, in a way, why I think the ground generals, both Montgomery and Bradley, were badly misled by their Air Force colleagues. Since then, yes, weapons have become more accurate, and civilian casualties are much lower. But, I mean, it's terrifying when one thinks in Normandy how many were killed as a result.
Today we talk about PTSD as one of the the things that happened to soldiers after the intensity of battle were the battles that followed, well, from D-Day on to the liberation of Paris. Were they of the sort that would have led to PTSD if we had used that diagnosis?
They certainly did. And, for example, you know, the U.S. Army, first U.S. Army alone, suffered over 30,000 shell shock, battle shock, PTSD casualties. British and Canadians were slightly less. But the Germans, strikingly enough, suffered very, very little. And this was noted by British and American psychiatrists after the war. And they could only attribute this to the fact of German preparation through propaganda from 1933 onwards had shown that they could prepare their soldiers better than obviously as civilian armies.
So what happened during the retreat? At a certain point, the Germans had to realize that they were defeated because they were moving eastward.
Oh, yes, and many of them did start to crack up at that point. But when you look at the suffering that they had, the bombing, the shelling, and all the rest of it, you would have expected far greater levels of battle shock amongst them than amongst the Allies.
How much French participation was there in the drive toward Paris?
Well, there was one division, which was, of course, the French 2nd Armoured Division, commanded by General Leclerc, equipped entirely by the Americans. This was hardly recognised by the French, the fact that they were in American vehicles and wearing American uniforms. But, of course, theirs was a political role as well, because de Gaulle feared a communist uprising and a communist seizure of power, and that was why he needed to get his troops there fast.
The great French chef, Pierre Frenet, who lived in the United States, came here for the World's Fair and then found himself stuck here because the Germans had invaded France, became an American citizen, joined the American military, and requested, as an officer, the right to liberate his hometown, told a story of coming into the town with this big American sergeant driving the Jeep. He was in the back, a little French man with a lot of medals on his uniform. And his father, the mayor, embraced the big strapping American and totally ignored him. but there was this other side. Many French were quite happy to see the American liberators, weren't they?
Absolutely. No, there was tremendous outpouring of joy. But it was soon afterwards, where that started to go sour.
Were these armies as brutal as the Russians had been in coming in the other direction?
Oh, goodness, no. I mean, there was inevitably there was a certain amount of sort of looting, and there were obviously cases of rape, but it was nothing in comparison to what was happening in Central Europe with the advance of the Red Army.
Americans could not understand why de Gaulle was so angry with America and Britain for so many years. Is that a direct result of what happened during this time?
Oh, yes, very much so. I think all of the tensions during the period of 1944 to 1944 and the immediate period afterwards, because Roosevelt refused to acknowledge his provincial government until he was virtually forced to.
We kept on hearing it was just that the French were too proud, or that de Gaulle thought France should be playing a major role in the world.
That was certainly true. I mean, there was tremendous frustration amongst the Americans and even the British when, at the end of the war, there was one victory parade after another, using American tanks, American gasoline, and all the rest of it, without a single American flag being displayed.
Anthony Beaver will be speaking and signing books tomorrow night at 7 at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble store. That's at 150 East 86th Street at 2nd Avenue. His book, his latest, is D-Day, The Battle for Normandy. It is published by Viking, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, Barbara Ehrenreich uncovers the dark side of constant positive thinking. Then Jonathan Lethem turns from Brooklyn to Manhattan in his latest novel, Chronic City. Also, second grade teacher Jennifer Scoggin, a.k.a. Mrs. Mimi, tells what it's like to commune with 7-year-olds for a living, plus our gurus of how-to, Alvin and Larry Ubell, tackle your home repair questions. And that's what's happening tomorrow. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Andrea Maraskin and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.